Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for joining us today. A new study finds students enrolled in online charter schools are not performing as well as students in traditional brick-and-mortar schools. At the same time, the number of virtual schools is growing. On today's show, we talk about the big business of online charter schools. Then, how do you talk about being gay and Christian, and who should be in on that conversation? That story later in the hour. But first, is Detroit really broke? That's the question before federal bankruptcy judge Stephen Rhodes, as Detroit's bankruptcy eligibility trial began today. His ruling could open the door for the city of Detroit to blow up billions of dollars in debt and liabilities. As has been the case ever since the bankruptcy filing on July 18th, this is all being closely watched from coast to coast. History is being written in Judge Rhodes' courtroom. Joining us to talk about what this trial means are two regular Stateside contributors, Daniel Howes, Detroit News business columnist, and the former chief of communications for the city of Detroit, Karen Dumas. Welcome to both of you. Daniel, put us all on the same page. Exactly what is this trial about?
Well, this trial is about determining whether Detroit, which filed for bankruptcy on July 18th, is actually eligible to file for bankruptcy. And this is a very high stakes for a lot of parties here, starting with, of course, the city of Detroit, who, if they are kicked out of bankruptcy court, will be back to a very difficult place and probably defaulting on a lot more financial obligations. To the unions and the pension funds, who are trying to forestall any effort to essentially gut their pension payments and their union contracts. And to the judge himself, who is presiding over the highest profile municipal bankruptcy in the history of the United States. So he's going to be very careful in terms of how he rules. He's already shown that he's very deliberate in looking at things, calling balls and strikes on both sides, and pressuring both sides on key issues of the law.
Karen, is there a part of you that's still pinching yourself going, we're here, how did this happen? Or was there ever any doubt that this was going to happen?
I don't think it's a pinch me kind of moment, because I think that we've seen these things come along for a long time, but they were just ignored, overlooked, or there was an inability to do something about it. If the mayor, this mayor, and even previous mayors had the sweeping power that Kevin Orr has, then perhaps some changes could have been made.
What kinds of things, besides resolving the debt, do you think need to be addressed and quickly?
Well, I've said before, this city has too many people doing too little for too few. I think internally there's operational restructuring. What we do, how we do it, the level of technology, the fact that it's not performance-based. I know that we have been saddlebagged by the fact that there have been a lot of bad commitments made in terms of, you know, union and work rules and what we're obligated to do, and that too has been unnecessary baggage. But, you know, we're not looking at the restructuring internally, and I think that that's going to come back and bite us in the foot.
Karen's exactly right. And as we're looking at this mayoral race that is culminating early next month, one of the issues that's being talked about on the campaign trail is Mike Duggan, for one, is saying that he wants to be the chief operating officer of the city as mayor, and that that would be what he believes would be his charge in the first year or so of his administration. Let me run the operations of the city. Let Kevin Orr work on the finances of the city, and we can work together, essentially, is what he's saying.
And isn't that actually, when we heard Mayor Bing last week, wasn't that Mayor Bing's understanding of how things were going to be when Kevin Orr came to town?
And that's what I was going to say. Mm-hmm. You know, so what would make us believe that Kevin Orr and the governor would allow that to happen under the new mayor when he's not necessarily allowed that to happen under the existing mayor? Kevin Orr has shown, you know, so he was supposed to be brought in to resolve the debt and the financial issues, but he's had his hand in a lot of things that have nothing to do with the debt or the finances, and that's not proven successful either. So, you know, again, I think that had, you know, he focused on the financial aspect, you know, I know that there were and have been plans on the table under this administration to resolve a lot of the inefficiencies in the city, allow those things to, you know, to work themselves out, given his power. I think we'd be in a different place right now.
We're speaking with Daniel Howes, Detroit News business columnist, and Karen Dumas, who was the former chief of communications for the city of Detroit, looking at the bankruptcy eligibility trial that began today. You know, it is really, really painful to see those retired city workers, so many of them elderly, so many infirm, and they did their share of the bargain. They served the city, and now they could be hit hard through absolutely no fault of their own. Has anyone caught any wind of any kind of settlement that could keep these people from feeling so much pain, or is the tank empty and there's nothing left to give?
There has been some discussion. Kevin Orr at one point talked about using some of the capital in the Water Department to reach us, to ease the pain a little bit, and elicited an enormous reaction from a lot of the suburban politicians and localities who are those customers and who have a piece of that business in a sense. And so I think, there is no question that there are a lot of retirees that stand to really get hurt in this whole thing. And all of the blame gets heaped, of course, on the governor and Kevin Orr. But, in fact, they're not the ones that made the decisions. There's a story in the front page of the New York Times, the business page today, talking about the cost of the 13th checks that Detroit pension funds cut for a lot of their pensioners. And essentially what they did was violate the whole concept of a pension. When a pension fund overperforms and does better than you're expected, you're not supposed to distribute the earnings to the members. What you're supposed to do is keep it in the fund so that when you have worse years, it balances out. Well, they didn't do that. And so as a result, they're much more underfunded than they otherwise would be.
Karen?
But see, you're walking a fine line, too, because now you want to, you can't penalize, one, the creditors want to be made whole, but certainly pensioners want to be made whole as well. I mean, what was it, a bad deal? You know, did the city not do what it could or should have done? Did they make poor decisions? Yes. But that's not a penalty that I think they should necessarily carry on their back. So I think that there is a balance here. You know, bankruptcy, would resolve the debt. You know, the creditors can write off that loss, but it will have a human interest impact on, a lot of the elderly people and older people, retirees, that are counting on this deal, albeit not necessarily ideal, for their livelihood. I mean, so there's a human interest element here, too. I've heard business people say, look, we want to move forward. We want the bankruptcy to, go ahead. So, provide some stability and the opportunity to restart for the city. But that's not necessarily the case when it comes to, the people that are involved and that will be impacted.
Karen's exactly right. And, there are also business people who are keeping a little quiet here while they philosophically support the bankruptcy, like she just said. They look at the human impact of this, and they kind of shrug their shoulders, or they kind of say, well, how do you get out of this?
Right.
And I think that's really the question that you're all raising, is there a way to get out of this and ease the pain for these people? Well, we don't know. That's what bankruptcy is all about, by the way, and that's what these negotiations are all about. And the plan that Kevin Orr put forth on June 14th, that basically was going to give them a major haircut is really an opening gambit in terms of some kind of negotiation. Now, I think their comeback is going to be that the city doesn't have the money, and that's one of the real issues. The other thing which we haven't talked about is the constitutional guarantee for vested pension benefits,
right?
And that is going to be tested very much in this. That's going to be, I think, one of the headline issues of this entire bankruptcy. Michigan is not the only state that has constitutional protection, and there's a lot of writing within the bankruptcy bar out there, and I've written about this, that basically comes to the conclusion that guarantee is probably not as ironclad as a lot of people think it is, particularly if it's done in a language that talks about it as a contract, which it does in Michigan, because in bankruptcy court, one of the key things about bankruptcy court is the ability to reject contracts.
Here's a question. What if Judge Stephen Rhodes agrees that the city did not bargain with creditors in good faith, or that PA 436 isn't constitutional, or that the city is not broke? Then what? Karen?
That's a good question. I mean, because you've got a lot of things in motion as though those things are going forward. So I would have absolutely no idea of where to start, and I can't imagine that those internally or those that have executed the decisions thus far would have any idea of how to recover from this. I really couldn't.
Dan?
Well, they say there's no plan B, and I think what's likely, I mean, I think most people that look at this think that the judge is going to find them insolvent, but there is a chance that he could kick it because he says they didn't bargain in good faith. And if that's the case, then you get into not only do you get back to square one, all of the protections and the automatic stay that was erected on the filing of the bankruptcy means that all this litigation would move forward. The city would default on more of its debt, and you'd be in a state of chaos. And you'd also have to throw an election in there. That also then really would ramp up, I would think, how important this election is going to be, because who's going to be in City Hall come January 1st? So you're going to have that issue, and the, and it's going to be back in the governor's lap, and he's going to have to make another decision in terms of how he's going to proceed.
And there's still the question of the remaining assets in the city in terms of whether or not the city would be considered insolvent or not. I mean, so, you know, I mean, a liquidation of existing assets, I mean, that's something that's still hanging over the city. You know, we're talking about the DIA. I know Belle Isle is going to the state park, but the city still has a lot of resources. We have an airport.
It does. That's true. But again, in Chapter 9, the test is cash flow insolvency for a municipality. It's not the value of its total assets. And so the judge has to look at whether it's cash flow insolvent. He can't look at the assets and say, well, you know, you've got $3 billion or whatever the number is of assets and all these in the airport and the DIA and all these other things and the water department, therefore you're not insolvent. That's not the test here, because the judge can't order the city to liquidate those assets, and neither can creditors. He can urge them to, and he can say, I'm not going to approve a plan of adjustment, but he can't say, you have to sell X, Y, and Z to raise cash.
Well, you've both given us so much to think about as we watch this proceed over the next week or so, and we really appreciate that. Daniel Howes, Detroit News Business columnist, and Karen Dumas, former Chief of Communications for the City of Detroit. Always good to have you on the program. Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Is Detroit really broke? That's the question before federal bankruptcy judge Stephen Rhodes, as Detroit's bankruptcy eligibility trial began today. His ruling could open the door for the city of Detroit to blow up billions of dollars in debt and liabilities. As has been the case ever since the bankruptcy filing on July 18th, this is all being closely watched from coast to coast. History is being written in Judge Rhodes' courtroom. Joining us to talk about what this trial means are two regular stateside contributors, Daniel Howes, Detroit News business columnist, and the former chief of communications for the city of Detroit, Karen Dumas. Welcome to both of you. Daniel, put us all on the same page. Exactly what is this trial about?
Well, this trial is about determining whether Detroit, which filed for bankruptcy on July 18th, is actually eligible to file for bankruptcy. And this is a very high stakes for a lot of parties here, starting with, of course, the city of Detroit, who, if they are kicked out of bankruptcy court, will be back to a very difficult place and probably defaulting on a lot more financial obligations, to the unions and the pension funds, who are trying to forestall any effort to essentially gut their pension payments and their union contracts, and to the judge himself, who is presiding over the highest-profile municipal bankruptcy in the history of the United States. So he's going to be very careful in terms of how he rules. He's already shown that he's very deliberate in looking at things, calling balls and strikes on both sides, and pressuring both sides on key issues of the law.
Karen, is there a part of you that's still pinching yourself, going, we're here, how did this happen? Or was there ever any doubt that this was going to happen?
I don't think it's a pinch me kind of moment, because I think that we've seen these things come along for a long time, but they were just ignored, overlooked, or there was an inability to do something about it. If the mayor, this mayor, and even previous mayors had the sweeping power that Kevin Orr has, then perhaps some changes could have been made.
What kinds of things, besides resolving the debt, do you think need to be addressed and quickly?
Well, I've said before, this city has too many people doing too little for too few. I think internally there's operational restructuring. What we do, how we do it, the level of technology, the fact that it's not performance-based. I know that we have been saddlebagged by the fact that there have been a lot of bad commitments made in terms of, you know, union and work rules and what we're obligated to do, and that too has been unnecessary baggage. But, you know, we're not looking at the restructuring internally, and I think that that's going to come back and bite us in the foot.
Karen's exactly right. And as we're looking at this mayoral race that is culminating early next month, one of the issues that's being talked about on the campaign trail is Mike Duggan, for one, is saying that he wants to be the chief operating officer of the city as mayor, and that that would be what he believes would be his charge in the first year or so of his administration. Let me run the operations of the city. Let Kevin Orr work on the finances of the city, and we can work together, essentially, is what he's saying.
And isn't that actually, when we heard Mayor Bing last week, wasn't wasn't that Mayor Bing's understanding of how things were going to be when Kevin Orr came to town?
And that's what I was going to say. You know, so what would make us believe that Kevin Orr and the governor would allow that to happen under the new mayor when he's not necessarily allowed that to happen under the existing mayor? Kevin Orr has shown, you know, so he was supposed to be brought in to resolve the debt and the financial issues, but he's had his hand in a lot of things that have nothing to do with the debt or the finances, and that's not proven successful either. So, you know, again, I think that had, you know, he focused on the financial aspect, you know, I know that there were and have been plans on the table under this administration to resolve a lot of the inefficiencies in the city, allow those things to, you know, to work themselves out, given his power. I think we'd be in a different place right now.
We're speaking with Daniel House, Detroit News business columnist, and Karen Dumas, who was the former chief of communications for the city of Detroit, looking at the bankruptcy eligibility trial that began today. You know, it is really, really painful to see those retired city workers, so many of them elderly, so many infirm, and they did their share of the bargain. They served the city, and now they could be hit hard through absolutely no fault of their own. Has anyone caught any wind of any kind of settlement that could keep these people from feeling so much pain, or is the tank empty and there's nothing left to give?
There has been some discussion. Kevin Orr at one point talked about using some of the capital in the water department to reach us, to ease the pain a little bit, and elicited an enormous reaction from a lot of the suburban politicians and localities who are those customers and who have a piece of that business in a sense. And so I think, there is no question that there are a lot of retirees that stand to really get hurt in this whole thing. And all of the blame gets heaped, of course, on the governor and Kevin Orr. But, in fact, they're not the ones that made the decisions. There's a story in the front page of the New York Times, the business page today, talking about the cost of the 13th checks that Detroit pension funds cut for a lot of their pensioners. And essentially what they did was violate the whole concept of a pension. When a pension fund overperforms and does better than you're expected, you're not supposed to distribute the earnings to the members. What you're supposed to do is keep it in the fund so that when you have worse years, it balances out. Well, they didn't do that. And so as a result, they're much more underfunded than they otherwise would be.
Karen?
But see, you're walking a fine line, too, because now you want to, you know, you can't penalize, you know, one, the creditors want to be made whole, but certainly pensioners want to be made whole as well. I mean, what was it, a bad deal? You know, did the city not do what it could or should have done? Did they make poor decisions? Yes. But that's not a penalty that I think they should necessarily carry on their back. So I think that there is a balance here. You know, bankruptcy, you know, would resolve the debt. You know, the creditors can write off that loss, but it will have a human interest impact on, you know, a lot of the elderly people and older people, retirees, you know, that are counting on this deal, albeit not necessarily ideal, you know, for their livelihood. I mean, so there's a human interest element here, too. You know, I've heard business people say, look, you know, we want to move forward. We want the bankruptcy to, you know, go ahead. So, you know, provide some stability and the opportunity to restart for the city. That's not necessarily the case when it comes to, you know, the people that are involved and that will be impacted.
Karen's exactly right. And, you know, there are also business people who are keeping a little quiet here while they philosophically support the bankruptcy, like she just said. They look at the human impact of this and they kind of shrug their shoulders, or they kind of say, well, how do you get out of this?
Right.
And I think that's really the question that you're all raising, is there a way to get out of this and ease the pain for these people? Well, we don't know. That's what bankruptcy is all about, by the way. And that's what these negotiations are all about. And the plan that Kevin Orr put forth on June 14th, that basically was going to give them a major haircut, is really an opening gambit in terms of some kind of negotiation. Now, I think their comeback is going to be that the city doesn't have the money. And that's one of the real issues. The other thing which we haven't talked about is the constitutional guarantee for vested pension benefits.
Right.
And that is going to be tested very much in this. That's going to be, I think, one of the headline issues of this entire bankruptcy. Michigan is not the only state that has constitutional protection. And there's a lot of writing within the bankruptcy bar out there, and I've written about this, that basically comes to the conclusion that guarantee is probably not as ironclad as a lot of people think it is. Particularly if it's done in a language that talks about it as a contract, which it does in Michigan, because in bankruptcy court, one of the key things about bankruptcy court is the ability to reject contracts.
Here's a question. What if Judge Stephen Rhodes agrees that the city did not bargain with creditors in good faith, or that PA 436 isn't constitutional, or that the city is not broke? Then what? Karen?
That's a good question. I mean, because you've got a lot of things in motion as though those things are going forward. So I would have absolutely no idea of where to start, and I can't imagine that those internally or those that have executed the decisions thus far would have any idea of how to recover from this. I really couldn't.
Dan?
Well, they say there's no plan B. And I think what's likely, I mean, I think most people that won't look at this think that the judge is going to find them insolvent. But there is a chance that he could kick it because he says they didn't bargain in good faith. And if that's the case, then you get into a seat. Not only do you get back to square one, all of the protections and the automatic stay that was erected on the filing of the bankruptcy means that all this litigation would move forward. The city would default on more of its debt. And you'd be in essentially, a state of chaos. And you'd also have to throw an election in there. That also then really would ramp up, I would think, the how important this election is going to be, because who's going to be in City Hall come January 1st? So you're going to have that issue, and it's going to be back in the governor's lap, and he's going to have to make another decision in terms of how he's going to proceed.
And there's still the question of the remaining assets in the city in terms of whether or not the city would be considered insolvent or not. I mean, a liquidation of existing assets, I mean, that's something that's still hanging over the city. You know, we're talking about the DIA. I know Bill Owl is going to the state park, but the city still has a lot of resources. We have a airport.
It does. That's true. But again, in Chapter 9, the test is cash flow insolvency for a municipality. It's not the value of its total assets. And so the judge has to look at whether it's cash flow insolvent. He can't look at the assets and say, well, you know, you've got $3 billion or whatever the number is of assets and all these in the airport and the DIA and all these other things and the water department, therefore you're not insolvent. That's not the test here, because the judge can't order the city to liquidate those assets, and neither can creditors. He can urge them to, and he can say, I'm not going to approve a plan of adjustment, but he can't say, you have to sell X, Y, and Z to raise cash.
Well, you've both given us so much to think about as we watch this proceed over the next week or so, and we really appreciate that. Daniel Howes, Detroit News Business columnist, and Karen Dumas, former Chief of Communications for the City of Detroit. Always good to have you on the program. Thank you.
Thanks very much.
There is one thing that seems crystal clear about those of you who are stateside listeners. Education really matters to you. Whenever we talk about education, about our children, you are all ears. So tomorrow at this time, you will not want to miss a powerful documentary produced by Jennifer Guerra for Michigan Radio's State of Opportunity Project. It's called The Education Gap. Jen Guerra joins us now to give us a preview. What questions are you asking in The Education Gap?
Well, I guess I sort of went into it with a couple questions, which is, why do kids who live in certain parts of the state get different types of education? So why does where you live determine the type of education you get? I also was very interested in hearing if there were possible solutions to this this problem.
This disparity?
The disparity, which obviously education and education funding is a very complex issue. There is no one simple solution, which I realized going in, but the responses have been very varied in terms of what can be done for the kids. And it's a problem that the state's been working on for decades and
spinning its wheels.
That's right.
Will you take us out of the realm of the experts and opinions, and you show us what this looks like? And tell us how you did that.
Sure. That's one of the really great things about State of Opportunity, is that we get time to tell the stories, and we get time to embed in classrooms and really get to know the people who are truly affected. So I chose two different fifth grades in two different districts. I chose one district which is solidly middle class, if not upper middle class, and then a district that is low income.
So you went to fifth grade classroom in Novi. Mm-hmm. The other district didn't want to be named.
Yeah. And I get it. They didn't want to be named because they didn't want people to blame them, really, for not having resources, or blame the kids and the parents for being poor.
Or the teachers or the,
right.
for what they have to do. Yeah.
Exactly. And so they felt that, you know, they just didn't want that attention really drawn to them. And I have to say, I mean, it was really very kind of them to even open their doors to me in the first place, because it is a very touchy subject. Mm-hmm. They do want people to know the challenges that face them. I often find, and I've spoken with other reporters about this, it's sometimes very hard to point out inequities when nobody wants to be the one to hold up the short end of the stick. And so, yeah, the two schools were very, very kind to let me pretty much hang out in their classrooms every day for a month and a half.
What struck you the most about the fifth grade classroom in that low-income district?
Well, first of all, I loved the kids. This is not in the documentary, but something I noticed was every time I would visit the low-income school, the kids would rush up to me, give me hugs, ask me why I hadn't been there the day before or when was I coming back. And the middle and upper middle class school in Novi, you know, they were just much more sort of, oh, she's here, she's not here. Like, who cares?
Kind of blasé.
Yeah. And I, you know, I have no hard and fast data on why that is, but it sort of felt like there was this stability issue in the low income school. And so they really kind of craved the attention that I was giving them and they wanted the stability of me being there. Whereas in the Novi school, it's like they go home and they go home to parents who are going to give them attention, and they have teachers who are able to give them a lot of attention. And so I'm just one more adult in the room. So that really struck me. I would say the noise level in the low-income school really struck me. It's a crowded classroom with a lot of kids, a lot of high-needs kids, and it was just so loud. I just felt bad for the teacher. There's no way she can get to all the kids during any particular subject, right? So maybe she's able to work with five or six kids, but you have 31, 32 kids in a classroom. And so you just see these kids kind of floundering, and they would ask me for help. Mm-hmm. And that was really eye-opening too.
You ask a question, can schools offset the effects of poverty? Can they?
You know, if I had an answer to that, I would, I don't know what I would be doing. I'd be a rich person. I asked so many people that question. I think I asked every expert I talked to that question. I also asked principals, and I think I might have even asked teachers. And everybody would say, yes. Okay, no, I would ask the question, can schools offset the effects of poverty? There'd be a long pause, almost to a T. There'd be a long pause, and then they would say, yes. I think they can. And then they'd go into a long explanation of like why it hasn't quite happened yet. And that to me was just, I'm disappointing to not have an answer.
Yeah.
As a reporter, you know, you want an answer.
Yeah.
And I just found that really interesting. Like, we just really have not figured this out.
The Education Gap is the Michigan Radio State of Opportunity documentary. It's airing tomorrow afternoon at 3 p.m. It is powerful. It will make you think. It will touch your heart, and you do not want to miss it. Jen Guerra, thank you so much for giving us a preview.
Thank you.
To parents seeking the best education for their kids, it is a whole new world out there, and it can be a confusing one. No longer is it an automatic choice to send your child to the public school in your neighborhood. Today, you have charter schools. There are online classes. And the subject of our discussion today, online K-12 charter schools. Joining us is Gary Marin. He's a professor of education at Western Michigan University. He recently co-authored a major piece along with Jessica L. Urschel for the National Education Policy Center. Its title, Understanding and Improving Full-Time Virtual Schools, a study of student characteristics, school finance, and school performance in schools operated by K-12, Inc. Gary Marin, welcome to Stateside.
Thanks, Cynthia.
Well, it wasn't long ago when many of us would have had absolutely no idea what an online charter school was. And now we're seeing this concept. It's opening in Michigan. It's in other states. Can you tell us how many are actually operating in Michigan?
In Michigan, the last data that we reviewed was from 2011 and 12, and at that time there was 13 of those operating. Two were large virtual schools operated by the for-profit companies, and the other are smaller district programs. And here I'm referring to the full-time virtual schools.
So just for parents who are still kind of wrapping their brains around this concept, so you are saying with this, we don't see classrooms, we don't see in-person teachers.
Right. And there's essentially three options. There's some families that are very familiar with the option where their child is offered to take one or more courses online through their high school or their middle school. The second option that we're starting to see are blended models, which are hybrid or blended models where students spend part of the week in a virtual environment and part of the week in a face-to-face environment. Mm-hmm. And then what our research is focused on is the fastest growing part, which is these full-time virtual schools where these schools get the full dollar for the full education.
And who are the big players? I know your study focused on the company K-12 Inc. out of Herndon, Virginia. And am I correct? They're the nation's largest virtual school provider?
They're the largest virtual school provider. In fact, they're the largest for-profit operator of public schools in the nation. They're even larger than brick-and-mortar charter school companies.
And do they have operations in Michigan?
They do. They operate one large school.
So what did you want to examine in this piece you did for the National Education Policy Center? When I see the title, Understanding and Improving Full-Time Virtual Schools, that immediately makes one conclude that there is certainly room for improvement.
Essentially, all the outcome variables, outcome indicators suggest that these schools are not performing very well. And along with some other researchers at the National Education Policy Center, some researchers from Columbia, from Arizona State University, and from the University of Colorado, and myself, we all agree that this is a pretty exciting future for education, the virtual school environment. And we're very excited about that, but we're very concerned about how this is taking shape. This opportunity space is largely being designed by these for-profit companies, and we believe that the performance could be better. But when we look at the outcome variables across the board, the results are very dismal.
Give us a sense of what you found when you looked at performance across the board. Overall, you use the term weak. How bad was it?
Well, in terms of adequate yearly progress, which is a crude measure, but it's a measure that we can use across states, it's essentially saying what percent of the virtual schools are meeting state standards. And across the nation, we found that 29% of the schools are meeting state standards. When we looked at the state ratings, we found that only about 27% had acceptable ratings in terms of their state accountability systems. When we looked at their average performance in math and reading, we found that they were between 5 and 10% behind in reading. And in math, it was rather shocking, but by high school, they fell 35 percentage point behind state averages in mathematics. And we also looked at graduation rates on time. Graduation rates are very poor there as well. I think less than a third of the students are graduating on time. When we look at attrition rates, the attrition rates are just phenomenally high. There's what we call student churn. There's a lot of student mobility in and out of these schools. In some states like Colorado, 50% of the students disappear during the year. According to K-12 itself, in its own annual report, they said two-thirds of the students disappear within 2 years. So there's very high attrition rates as well. So these are all kind of crude measures, but they are all negative. There was one very rigorous study done by Credo Research Center at Stanford University. They found the 8 virtual schools in Pennsylvania were statistically far behind brick-and-mortar charter schools, which were also behind then the district schools. So across the board, we haven't seen any promising evidence, and yet, you know, we do have hope. We think that this is a pretty exciting opportunity, an area for growth, but thus far, the results are dismal. And that's why that with this report, we really want to bring attention to the issue and caution policymakers, like, let's stop and get this right.
Before rushing into supporting this.
Before lifting the caps, before rolling this out, before rushing into it. And that's what we're doing today, largely driven by very effective lobbying by these for-profit companies.
I'm speaking with Gary Marin, who's a professor of education at Western Michigan University and recently co-authored a major study looking at the whole idea of an online K-12 charter school. And why do you think the performance is so weak, Gary? I mean, you found these troubling performance results. Why is it?
Well, I think right now the monetary incentives are great for these for-profit companies, and the monetary incentives are based on how many students they get in the door and how many students are there on the fourth Friday headcount. So their recruiting strategies are simply to recruit anybody and everybody they can get in the door. Many of the students that they are serving today don't have the metacognitive skills that are required to succeed in this model. By that, I mean they don't self-regulate. They're not self-disciplined. Many of them don't have a structured home environment in which to work online. Many of them don't have an adult instructor because this model depends on an adult in the home who is the primary instructor, and then the teacher at the virtual school is often providing a resource and support for that parent as teacher. So they're recruiting anybody and everybody right now. now because that's how the funding encourages them to do so.
And teacher compensation doesn't measure up well, does it?
No, they're not paid very well, and especially now we see with K-12, close to 10% of their students have identified disabilities or they have individualized education plans, which means they're now tapping into federal and state dollars set aside for special ed. But when we analyze their spending patterns, very little money is spent on teachers and even less is spent on special ed dollars. So we don't know where that money is going, but obviously given the outcomes, we are concerned that it's not being spent on instruction.
And Gary, could a possible explanation for this weak performance just be the fact that the curriculum is inadequate?
I mean, that's one possibility. I think some of these companies that are starting the schools, some of them are connected with textbook companies, and they do have a very strong background in terms of curriculum. Others may not. I think the primary issue about performance, however, is still that having that adult in the household. And also for these models, many of them are just not spending enough on instruction. We're seeing teacher-to-student ratios of 60 to 120 students per full-time teacher at these virtual schools, and it's just not adequate. And again, they're not spending in those areas. And given the outcomes, we would expect them to be saying, wake up. Uh-oh, it's time to, we have to start investing more in instruction. And yet we don't see them doing that. Instead, they're spending more and more money on advertising and recruitment.
Can you give us an idea and explain to us the difference between, let's say, having my child attend one of these online charter schools and me doing the homeschooling? How would that differ and how would that be the same?
First, I want to be clear. Many of these schools, the large ones, tend to be charter schools, but now we're seeing school districts themselves operating their own full-time virtual schools.
Right.
These tend to be much smaller and also tend to focus just on the high school grades. But now the difference with the homeschooling is early on with these full-time virtual schools, many of the students that turned to these schools were the students who were being homeschooled. So for the charter schools that went into this marketplace, they were able to tap new resources because bringing these students back into the public school system meant that there would be new allocations and funding for them. So they're tapping into those students. And many of those students, I think, succeeded or performed better because they were already used to working in a self-regulated environment and a structured home environment with a parent as a primary teacher. But that shifted about 5 or 6 years ago as we saw just enormously fast growth, not only in the number of states that were permitting these full-time virtual schools, but in the actual enrollments. And when a new virtual charter or new charter school opens up, a brick-and-mortar charter school, they may start with anywhere between 100 and 250 students and grow to become maybe 250 to 400 students. With these virtual schools, they will grow. Some of them are opening with 1 to 3,000 students and growing to have more than 11,000 students at a single school.
As you studied these schools, did you look into the partnerships between education officials in states where K-12, Inc., and other companies that offer online education, and the relationship between those officials and foundations and companies who will be making money from all of this? Did you find relationships that were too cozy for your liking?
Oh, certainly. And it wasn't our analysis, but The Nation magazine has done a very in-depth analysis of that purchasing of influence by K-12 and working with ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council. They've developed model legislation, and they have a very effective program now working from state to state to introduce new legislation that will lift caps and expand this type of schooling. And again, we're not opposed to this type of schooling. Mm-hmm. We just want to slow down, figure out how to make it work, and then roll it out.
And I do hear you say very clearly that you see exciting possibilities for students with this kind of education. So the question is now, based on what you found out and where we are right now, what should parents take away from what you have found about these online charter schools?
I think, many students are turning to these schools because they see the advertisements on Nickelodeon or the various sources where they're, spending a lot of money recruiting students. But for the parents, they need to wake up and look at these schools and think about the effects it may have on their students, pulling them from a brick-and-mortar school perhaps and then having to re-enroll them. But I think it's very critical for parents, if they're going to choose this route, that they have an adult at home who's ready to be the primary instructor. Otherwise, it's an area that's probably the biggest concern right now is parents just assume that the student is going to have direct interactions with their teachers, and they're going to get all this support. And it doesn't really happen. It's mostly dependent on a student and self-guided instruction. And so the student has to be very motivated and have those kind of self-regulatory, you know, behavior that in place.
And what recommendations, Gary, would you offer for policymakers? What would you say to the folks in Lansing looking at how much of this to allow in Michigan?
I think looking at outcomes, we need to stop growing the full-time virtual schools. We need to figure out why they're not performing well. We need to look at new accountability measures for them, and we need new funding mechanisms, because I think if the funding mechanisms were changed, the incentives would change and they would change their behavior. I think the second thing that we need to keep in mind is there is very promising research on the blended and hybrid models, and there's just a wide array of new models of education that are combining virtual schools with face-to-face instruction. Those probably show the most promise and I think should be higher on the priority of policymakers.
Gary Marin, professor of education at Western Michigan University, and he recently co-authored a major piece along with Jessica L. Urschel for the National Education Policy Center. Gary Marin, thank you for speaking with us today.
Thanks, Cynthia.
You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Cynthia Canty. Let's agree to disagree, and then let's find ways to be witnesses for Christ together. That seems to be the message of the Gay Christian Network, which calls itself the nation's largest interdenominational LGBT Christian organization. The founder of the Gay Christian Network is Justin Lee. Justin is in West Michigan this week, one of the most religiously conservative areas of the state. Last night, he spoke at Calvin College, and this Friday evening, he'll speak at the Room for All National Conference at Central Reformed Church in Grand Rapids. Justin Lee, welcome to Stateside.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So the mission statement for the Gay Christian Network says, we want to share Christ's light and love everywhere, not to hide in a gay Christian bubble somewhere. How are you doing that?
Well, you know, many of us grew up wrestling with our faith and either our own sexuality or that of those close to us, people we cared about. And so for many of us, this was a very personal journey, trying to figure out, if I'm Christian and I realize that I'm gay and I've always believed it's a sin to be gay, what do I do about that? But we don't want to just stay having this conversation with other folks who are going through the same things, because this is really a conversation going on a national and international level, both within the church and in the broader culture. So we do a lot to share stories of folks from very different backgrounds with very different theological viewpoints, and provide resources to folks on all sides of these questions who want a way to have a conversation that's not as polarized as so much of the culture war that's going on right now.
So you are not there to get folks to change their minds about what it is to be gay.
Right, insofar as our goal is not to change people's theological viewpoints on sexual morality or whether or not they approve of same-sex marriage from a theological standpoint.
Mm-hmm.
But we do want to change people's minds as far as to say, if there's somebody you don't agree with on this issue and you've always written them off, either written them off as a homophobe and a bigot or written them off as a sexual deviant who wants nothing to do with God or whatever the case may be, we want you to reconsider that position and think of this other person who you may disagree with very strongly as a human being who deserves love and respect and grace, and we want to inject more of that grace into the conversation. And so, you know, I'm not suggesting that Christians shouldn't take positions on whether or not something is sinful, that we shouldn't have any kind of moral standards. I don't believe that at all. But I do think that if the church is known today more for being judgmental and looking down on people than for loving people, then we've gotten it backwards.
I'm speaking with Justin Lee. He's the founder of the Gay Christian Network, and he is in West Michigan this week holding a series of speeches, just reaching out to really what's one of the most religiously conservative areas of the state. And Justin, you were raised Southern Baptist. And I'm wondering how hard it was for you to reconcile that faith tradition with the fact that you realized you were gay. So therefore, there were people in the pews of your church that viewed your behavior as reprehensible.
Well, at that point, you know, it wasn't even behavior. When I first realized I was gay, I had always believed that being gay was something people chose and that it was a sinful choice.
Mm-hmm.
And I had been very public in saying, you know, I think homosexuality is a sin. And I didn't really distinguish between, homosexuality is a very broad term. I often say to people, what would it mean if I said heterosexuality before marriage is a sin? You know, if a 12-year-old girl notices there's a cute guy in her class, that's heterosexuality before marriage. But I hadn't really thought about it that deeply. I believed it was a sinful choice. So when I began to realize that I was gay, that I was attracted to guys, mm-hmm. and that didn't seem to be going away, I didn't know what to do with that, because that wasn't something I thought could happen to a good Christian boy. And so I found that many of the Christians I knew and loved and trusted and respected condemned me just on the basis of what I was feeling. I wasn't dating anybody. I wasn't sexually active. I hadn't even decided what my future was going to look like. But they just didn't know how to talk about these questions. And so ultimately, I started the Gay Christian Network as a space where people who may have come to very different theological conclusions can sit down and talk about these questions and have conversations with folks who may not agree with them, but know that they're not going to be treated poorly or judged or kicked out for having an opinion that someone else doesn't agree with.
Justin, do you find certain denominations or certain groups of people are more or less willing to entertain this conversation?
Well, I think certainly there are some denominations that are, as a whole, having more of this conversation in a more respectful way than others. But I think that it's often a sort of a church-by-church, group-by-group, family-by-family a kind of thing. It's hard to generalize too much.
Mm-hmm. What about ages? Do you see differences between older people or younger people?
Well, I think a lot of younger people, because we have a generation who's grown up now with friends who identify as gay from a young age, they understand a lot more about what it means to be gay, and that affects how they have the conversation. But I find that many of them are getting very frustrated with the church. So while their parents may be still struggling to talk about homosexuality, to talk about gay people, may not even know terms like LGBT, lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender, the younger generation, to a large extent, is struggling with whether they even want to remain members of a church that many of them view as being really behind the times and very judgmental and bigoted. And so I want to change that reputation because I love the church, and I don't want to see that be the way that we're known.
What are your hopes for what might come out of your outreach this week in West Michigan?
I want to help provide people with some tools to have these conversations better. I find, for instance, that a lot of debate and argument on this subject could be avoided if people stopped at the beginning and defined their terms. I mean, even a term like gay, we did a survey last year of evangelical college students and found that many of the conservative straight evangelical college students used the term gay or straight to refer to people's behavior, people's sexual behavior, whereas their gay and lesbian friends use terms like gay and straight to refer to people's attractions, regardless of their behavior.
Hmm.
So right off the bat, you've got two people trying to have a conversation about whether being gay is a choice, for instance, and they don't even mean the same thing when they say gay. And so I find that if people understand that these are things that they need to stop and talk about first, it helps make the conversation go a lot more smoothly. So I want to share some of those kinds of tips with folks, in the hopes that people will be able to go back to their churches and their families and talk to the people they don't agree with and have those conversations be more respectful and more productive.
Justin, is it tough sometimes being the guy kind of in the center of the firing range?
Absolutely, absolutely. I've been in that place since starting the Gay Christian Network back in 2001. I've been criticized by the left and the right. A lot of folks make assumptions based on the name of the organization about what we stand for, and they always seem to assume that I stand for whatever they don't agree with. And then my book, Torn, just came out in last November, and that has made me even more of a public figure on this. And so I do hear from a lot of folks on both sides who want to give me a piece of their mind, and I just try to listen and give them a chance to say what they want to say and show them grace. And often that helps to calm things down a lot.
Justin Lee is the founder of the Gay Christian Network. He will be speaking at 7:30 Friday night at a Room for All National Conference, and that will be held at the Central Reformed Church in Grand Rapids. Justin, thanks so much for talking with us today on Stateside.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
There's much talk in Michigan, and really across America, about the local food movement. For many food activists, eating locally sourced foods isn't just a pleasure, it is a moral obligation. They maintain locally sourced food is better for the entire planet than shipping food thousands of miles across oceans, across continents. Is eating local always worth it? What works? What doesn't? We're joined by Dr. Margot Finn. She's a lecturer at the University of Michigan, specializing in food, popular culture, and class. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So in the long run, do we save more energy and carbon dioxide by eating local?
Well, it really depends. So transportation is only one part of the food system. And according to some people, the Leopold Center for Sustainable Agriculture has done some of the work on this, transportation is actually a relatively small part of the overall food production system, particularly in terms of fossil fuel usage and carbon dioxide emissions, which are the things that people are usually concerned about when they're concerned about the environmental impact.
So, but it's become such an overarching, big, major part when you talk about the food miles and that. How did it get so overblown?
Well, I think it's an easy thing for people to focus on, right? When we're concerned about things like greenhouse gas emissions, cars and transportation come to mind. And it's true, a lot of the food that we're eating is being transported very long distances. But it turns out that that's only about 10% of the fossil fuel usage in the food industry. So production, and particularly processing in homes and restaurants, is actually where a lot of the energy is getting used. So it might be that producing something very efficiently and then transporting it as efficiently as possible long distance could be better, at least in terms of fossil fuel use and greenhouse gas emissions, than producing it inefficiently somewhere and then perhaps transporting it inefficiently and then particularly having consumers making extra trips to buy that produce. So you might actually have more food miles involved in local production than in very distant production.
I would dare say that I think most people who feel very involved in the local food movement are surprised to hear that, would not have been aware of that.
That's true. I mean, I think the intentions are great. I think that when people are buying local food, they really are trying to reduce their impact. I think it's a way that is, you know, people can feel good about what they're doing, right? They're taking an action that they feel like is really going to make a difference. Whether or not it's actually making that difference is kind of, I think it's up in the air. It depends on the product that you're buying. It depends on whether or not you're making extra car trips to get it. It depends on how it's being processed or how you're processing it at home.
Now, I'm wondering, is eating local something that costs more and thus becomes a class and an income issue and also availability? Do people in more affluent areas have more access to that local food?
I think that's another thing that's definitely happened. I think because it is often more expensive, takes more time, farmers markets are usually not convenient to – well, not convenient to everybody. They're not open all the time the way a 24-hour supermarket is. It might even actually be the familiarity with the ingredients and the knowledge that people have or the ability to turn these things into recognizable food more than the prices in some cases. So if you know how to use kale and kohlrabi and these kinds of things, then you have an advantage in terms of using the produce that's available at the farmer's market. But because there, you know, it's this distinctive sort of buying, I think it has become a mark of class. So not just for the price, but also just the culture around food.
Kind of, it's cool to be part of this.
Absolutely.
So that sounds like people who could use the values of local food are kind of being left out of the party.
I mean, I guess there's the bigger question of does local food do anything good in the first place, right? So we might not want to be encouraging more people to buy local.
So what do you think? Does local food do any good in the first place? Let's start with right there.
Not always. I guess I would say that I don't think local is a very good proxy for environmental sustainability. I think that there are so many factors involved in whether or not something is produced in a sustainable way, and its proximity to you is not the best indicator. So you don't know when something is produced locally. Are they using no-till methods? Are they producing things in a way that's using the least amount of, I guess, capital investiture? So the more small farms that we have, each one of which has structures and tractors and all that, that has an impact too. So large farms that have less equipment for the number of calories that they're producing might be more efficient, or are producing many more calories on a smaller amount of land. Those kinds of efficiencies can make a big difference in terms of whether or not we're being sustainable.
It sounds like, Margo, you're saying it's not about absolute. So therefore, large does not necessarily mean bad or not sustainable.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
So what kind of mindset adjustments do you think would be useful for the food buying public to take when it thinks about local food?
Well, I guess I'm skeptical about the ability for consumption to be a major driver of sustainability in the first place. I think we need policy fixes. I think we need to make to figure out what would be sustainable in the first place and then make those choices the easiest choices for people to make. I think before we do that, the idea that we can rely on people to always be spending more time and more money to make the right choices, most people don't have access to or the time to do those kinds of things. So as long as our sustainable choice is seen as something that really requires a sacrifice on most people's part, I don't think that's going to be broad enough to make a real change. So I think the first thing would be to think about big policy changes that we can make. But if a consumer really wanted to be doing the right thing, which I know a lot of people do, seek out life cycle analyses if you can.
What is that?
So that's an overall measure of the energy and all the other kinds of factors that go into producing food. So an LCA, so food miles is only a measure of how far something traveled,
okay,
right?
Okay.
And again, that's a very small part of the overall energy that goes into food production. An LCA tries to do something more holistic and look at all of the energy that goes into the production of food. And it takes transport into account too. So, and when people do these analyses and look at different kinds of options, they come up with, you know, there's some like startling facts, right? So for people in Britain, it's actually more efficient to eat lamb that's produced in New Zealand than it is to eat the local lamb. And in part, that's because in New Zealand, the lambs are frolicking around and eating grass and they're not having feed imported. So there's a lot of inputs that aren't going into the lamb. So even though it's transported halfway around the world,
yeah,
and it is transported super efficiently and usually in shipping containers. So that's another thing that's helpful. But I think when they did the analysis, they were assuming that even if it was transported in a way that used more greenhouse gas emissions, that's still better than having a lamb in a heated barn somewhere in Britain where it's being fed things that have to be transported, grain feed that's transported in. So a life cycle analysis identifies the hot spots in food production. It tries to find out not just how far something has traveled, but where is the energy actually getting used?
And where would a concerned consumer find that?
They are very difficult to find, and I mean, you can. So Google's a great source for all kinds of information, right? So start with Google. But there are people doing these kinds of analyses. So the Leopold Center, again, for Sustainability has been doing kinds of analysis on what kinds of agriculture is more or less productive. And you know, this research is out there, but it does get quite complex. And I think that, you know, that goes back to the question of, can consumers make the right choices? Mm-hmm. And I don't know if consumers actually have most people certainly don't have the time to navigate all these kinds of issues.
That's so true.
So can you personally make the most sustainable choice? I don't know. I don't know if you have if people really have the time, energy, ability, interest even to make personally the right choices all the time.
Interesting food for thought. Dr. Margo Finn, lecturer in university courses at the University of Michigan. And she was kind enough to join us in the studio. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Today's program was produced and directed by Mercedes Mejia. Stateside was engineered today by Bob Scon. Contributors are Allie Billings, Emily Fox, Renee Gross, Katie Suha, and John K. Wilson. This program's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.